So yeah, Ollie pulling out of today's pods messed up my show, man. Because I had some Tottenham banter, man. But
yeah,
you can't even banter Ollie anymore because he's just like,
he's either that or he's just mad aggressive. It's not worth the beef.
I'm miswinding him up, man. You can't even wind him up anymore.
Yeah. I mean, he used to get it bad. Maybe when we get back to the studio, you wind him up then.
Maybe.
You know, when people have kids and stuff, they settle, you know?
True. But I think he'll go further the other way. I think he'll care even less. Do you know what I mean? When he becomes a dad, I think he'll be like, I just don't care anymore. I've got a beautiful baby now. I ain't got time for no Spurs rubbish.
Man, there's a lot of rubbish over there as well.
Oh, bro, I want to chat about the cup final. And anyway, we'll do it next time. There's no rules. So just to let listeners know, we're going to be getting various guests on. I'm joined by G at the moment. Marvin will be with us soon. Ollie is busy today. We'll have various guests to talk about a variety of different things. While I've got you on your own, G, let's give the mic to you. Just, I don't want to dwell too much on the Super League thing because it feels like it's a little bit
dead now. Yeah,
it's a bit done. Yeah, but just kind of generally, what were your thoughts on the proposal and the collapse?
Yeah, you see, when the news first broke on the day, I was kind of relaxed about it because there was a lot of hyperbole, particularly Gary Neville. I mean, a lot of people liked the passion and the energy that he put into it, but I felt like he was talking before he knew the whole of the facts. There was a lot of things that are thrown around, like the six teams are going to leave the league and all this type of stuff. And I was like, okay, let's see what happens. And I was just thinking, it just won't be as bad as what people say. And it wasn't, but it was still bad. Like it was still trying to kind of branch off, have, you know, the clothes shop thing is the thing that worried me the most. Like, I'm not really worried about, like, I mean, the format, okay, I don't like it, but UEFA's format isn't much different. So who cares about that? But to actually say you have six founder clubs and the clubs almost can dictate who can come in, who can play. It was mad. It was unthinkable. Like, but at the same time, I was quite relaxed about it. I mean, a lot of people have gone down and protest and all that. I just didn't think it would happen, or I didn't think it would happen in the form that it was in now. And to be honest, I still wouldn't rule out it happening in the future. I'm not even talking the long-term future. I still wouldn't rule out if, you know, Real Madrid came back and said, you know what, okay, people are pissed about the closed shop element. Let's open that up. Because, in Madrid, we'll get to the Champions League every year anyway. You know what I mean? So we'll qualify for the Super League everyway.
I think it's a really good point you made, G. I agree that I don't think this is over. Secondly, I wasn't necessarily anti-Super League like you. What I was anti was the structure of the Super League. It wasn't competition. Yeah. That's not sport. You can't just decide we're the biggest clubs in Europe, therefore we're going to break away, form our own league, and there's no consequences for us being poor. And whatever you do in your leagues across Europe, it doesn't matter because you can't come to this party. I didn't like that. That's not sport. But I agree with you when you talk about they may well come back, because for me it's a thing of, if they just tweaked it a little bit, I think maybe it's a test. I genuinely think maybe they're just thinking, we put this radical thing out there, hear the kind of furore, and then kind of like, okay, so you like that and that, but that you don't. Cool, we'll lose that bit. We'll still have our thing. So.
It's totally possible. And Perez is really like, you know, he's swinging. He's still saying it's still going to go ahead.
He's not letting it go,
is he? He's not letting it go. It's like a dog of a bone.
He's talking about lawsuits. They've signed contracts. And I'm like, yo, this guy is being very stubborn, or he's just, I don't know, dumb. I don't know. One of the two, anyway. Let me introduce our first of our many guests on today's show. We have my boy Mo, a big Arsenal fan. How you doing, sir? Let me bring you in.
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you very much. Nice to be here, Jordan. And unfortunately, I've come into the conversation at a point where you mentioned the name of Fiorentino Perez.
It's not a good entry point, is it? It's not really a good entry point. So today's show is going to be a bit of a mishmash. We've got various people coming in and out of the pods. I was just saying to Gabriel.
Yeah, I've met before.
We've met before, of course you have. I was just saying to Gabriel that I don't want to dwell too much on the Super League because it feels a little bit, in terms of last week's episode, kind of done. But just briefly, because I wanted to get you on to talk about Arsenal's supposed and then participation and the future for Arsenal. But just generally, what were your thoughts on the proposal and the collapse?
Absolutely disgusted. But, you know, I think a lot of it has been said. So I'll say something that probably hasn't been said in a long time. For me, it's just the absolute shock that these billionaires, you know, society tells us billionaires are the most successful people on earth. They're the ones to be looked up to, blah, blah, blah. Billionaires did not have kind of a backup, proper thought. You know, it just surprises me that they were bullied by fans and players and managers. And I just thought to myself, did you not even see that coming in any capacity? I would have thought they'd at least have a contingency to deal with that. Or, you know, I thought they'd ride it out. So I was really surprised, actually, that it got up and folded so quickly. And I find it amazing from when we first heard about the Super League to what you just said now, that you don't want to dwell on it because last week and now it's kind of all over. How the hell can the inception and the demise of a European Super League occur so quickly? I think these billionaires have had some real humble pie.
Well, to your point, just as you came in, G was making the point that I actually agree with, that maybe the plan was to almost play dumb. So let's put this thing out there now, feel the lay of the land, see what everyone's in uproar about, tweak it, and then give them the Super League. So my biggest thing with the Super League was the lack of the fact that 12 clubs decide we can't be relegated. So they may well come back in 6 months and say, all right, cool, we're bringing it back again, but we'll scrap the idea that you can't be relegated. What are you going to complain about now?
I buy the latter, but I don't buy the former of what you've just said. Mm. The latter being that, yes, they might come with a different iteration and learn, of course, that's not hard. But the former, jobs were lost, reputations were destroyed. You know, the fallout was way too big for us to say that was calculated and anticipated. It took them by surprise. I don't think there's any doubt about that. CEOs quit. You know, there was proper fallout from this. Managers were sacked. There was proper fallout from this. And also, as fans, we see what other fans have done. I don't think we've seen what happened behind the scenes. Players and managers, the conversations they would have been having, I think would have been quite interesting for owners. And I don't think they expected the backlash. They've been caught out.
Do you believe that this was down mainly to fan power, and they saw the reaction of fans across England in particular and thought, whoa, we've misjudged this? Or do you think that's been overblown?
Can two opposite points of view be smart at the same time? I think it was down to fan power, but don't get me wrong, but I think they think of the knock-on effect of fan power in terms of reputation. So for JP Morgan, there's reputation. For Man United, there's reputation. I think if it was just football fans protesting and it was in like a insular bubble where it was just the core football fans were protesting, but everyone else was cool with it, I think they would have been fine. I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, like these protests, I mean, Perez made a joke about there was 40 people at Stamford Bridge. I had to laugh when he said that because obviously there's a little more. But he makes a fair point. It's not like the whole country came out of protest.
This wasn't an Iraq war type protest, was it?
Yeah, exactly.
Can I just say, right, when I say it's fans, I know that if they wanted to, they could have just ridden it out. They could have. Yeah. But what fans did was got parties involved at such a high level. We're talking about the PM of the country, whatever the hell you think of him, and you can guess what I think of him. But Boris Johnson got involved. An actual review is being led by the Department of Culture, Media and Sport, by Tracy Crouch, to look into football ownership reform. Now, they did not anticipate that. So I don't think what scared them into submission was fans shouting outside grounds. What scared them into submission was, at the very, very high level, a change of policy potentially, which could hugely limit their earning potential if that reform is as strong as you want it to be. But why did that reform occur? Why did that government intervention occur? Because of fan power. So that's just how I think the dominoes fell. So that's why I think the fans deserve the credit and how they impacted it.
I was at Stamford Bridge, as I was saying earlier on.
With 40 people.
But to be fair, there was more than 40 people. There was more than 40 people. Not much more, but there was more than 40 people. And you know, the fans were angry. I think there was an element of lockdown fatigue. And what I mean by that is, I think for a year we've been locked down. Any excuse to just come out, shout and run around the streets. You know what I mean? I think there was an element of that. But granted, people were upset about what their teams were doing. Were you, Chelsea fans are a bit of a different breed. You guys are different, G. Were you, you said that you wasn't overtly against the idea of a Super League, but do you think it would have been to the detriment of the English game? And how much do you care if so?
I think it would have been to the detriment. And yeah, I do care, actually.
Be honest, G, be honest. No, I know you're Chelsea fans. As long as you're winning and you're doing well, that's all you care about.
Seriously. I mean, look, on the one hand, the Champions League does what the Super League does money-wise to the other clubs, just to a smaller extent. Yeah? And to be fair, it's out of the six teams that they mentioned, apart from Leicester, are generally getting into the Champions League anyway. So there generally is that gap, but it's the widening of that gap. And it's like, and I think it's more the thing that, at least the clubs like Leicester, Villa, Everton, they kind of still believe, they have this dream, they have this hope. And that's what keeps like the middle half of the Premier League competitive. If there's no qualification, you're taking out the dreams of that, but also you're taking out the battle for top four. You're killing the competitiveness of the league. It's like it will be relegation and whoever wins the league, and that's pretty much it. And that's the knock-on effect that it has. And especially for guys like you, George, where you're not really into Champions League anyway, like the league means something.
All right, mate. Cheap shot there. All right.
Yeah, but no. I do care. If not from a moral and ethical standpoint, more from a competitive standpoint, I wouldn't want to see a Premier League where who finished in the top four didn't matter, or that race didn't matter. I think that's a big part of one of the few things that you can enjoy at Premier League football anymore.
You say that, G, but if the Super League happened, you'd be watching the Super League. So you wouldn't be the Premier League to you then would be like the Championship is to you now. You wouldn't really care, would you? Be honest. Come on.
Yeah, I hear
you. You ain't watching Burnley versus Brighton.
Listen, I like the combination of both. Like, I like it all. And I also like what I didn't like about the Super League. Like, we play Real Madrid tomorrow. It's the first time we played Real Madrid since 1998. Like, I like that those games are rare, that those games are special. I think if you play them every week, like, we're oversaturated with football now. We've got the Nations League. We've got more teams in the Europa League, more teams in the Champions League, and the games are not better. They're not more competitive. And I think, yes, the argument would be for this is that you're facing the top teams off against each other. But those are the few and rare special games that we get. So if you make those games even less special, but I think you generally have an impact on how football is enjoyed. And that was my main thing about it. Not the ethical and the money, because UEFA are crooks as well, and FIFA are crooks as well. I can't, all of that about the money stuff, that's someone else's fight. What my fight is this would not have been the best for competitive football, and especially in this country. And I think, and that's why I'm happy it didn't go ahead.
Mo, you at the protest at the Emirates on Friday, excuse me. Dumb question, what are your thoughts about the owners? I'll ask a different question. Did you lose a little bit of love for your club based off what they were trying to do? We all know that there's money to be made and this is a business. Let's not be naive about that. But the idea that, as G says, this wasn't just about, you know, billionaires making more money. This is all about also about culture of football and football fandom, and Arsenal signing up to be a part of that. Did you lose just a little bit of love for your team?
Oh, more than a little bit, Jordan. Much more than a little bit. And you know, that I think that was probably shared by many, many fans, and that's what saw so many fans come out and be so vocal, and the wider reaction by the football community. And the thing is, look, you know, as a match-going fan in the UK, you notice when you walk up some grounds, home and away, across, you know, the league or whatever, even like cup ties and that sort of thing. You go to Goodison Park, you go to Highbury if you went there back in the day, you go to grounds like Selhurst Park, they are surrounded by houses. You know, it's not like an American model where you drive to, you know, out of the city and loads of cars are up there and you're parking in a huge car park. that's not the vibe here. These aren't purpose built to be sort of, you know, franchise type institutions. They were community institutions. They belonged to the neighborhood. Mm. And I think that surprises people when you see a huge stadium and then terraced housing surrounding the whole place. Mm. So to me, the fact that this is a community, it's got a community history, and the fact that they were looking to rubbish that history, someone five sort of meters away from the ground, like their house could be opposite the ground, they would not be able to, you know, they'd almost be priced out of the games and not even really be able to properly be a match-going fan anymore because of the fact that, you know, you have to go to Europe to go and watch your team play in the league. You know, all of it really, really bothered me, really upset me. And it's not the first time Arsenal's actions in you know, the last couple of years have hurt me kind of on a personal level. But this did, it saddened me.
What was it like being at the protest? You know, being down there, you know, G and a WhatsApp group were in, tried to make some jokes about there's three people at the Emirates. And then very quickly became clear there was more than three people at the Emirates. Well, you'd like to think there was three people there, G, to kind of ask all it up, and even we can't even protest properly. But what was it like being down there at the Emirates when there was clearly a lot of anger and strong feeling towards what the owners tried to do?
It was brilliant. And what I was worried about, right, Jordan, was that I thought it might feel a bit anemic. We might all go there and it could feel like a few thousand observers rather than a few thousand protesters. But you know what? I knew it'd be well attended because I've gone and seen Arsenal across the world and I've never, ever been disappointed. I know we're a big club and there's a huge amount of passion. So I knew that it'd be attended. But what I loved and what I found really, really nice about it was that in like the 48 hours of notice that people had that, fine, let's go protest. Number one, it wasn't convenience led. It wasn't a case of because we're going to watch a game, let's meet an hour earlier and do something. Mm-hmm. This was the event in itself. So afterwards, to watch the game, people just dispersed and just went home. I met fans that had come from Bournemouth, for example, all the way for this. I did a 100-mile round trip from where I live to come and do it, to come and attend it. I mean, really, watching the game, I could have watched in the comfort of my living room. That's the best option for me right now. So that's what I really liked, the sincerity of it. It wasn't convenience-led. The second thing that I really liked was that people really took the effort to not be observers. They did whatever they could, writing on bedsheets, printing placards out, whatever the hell it might have been. They went there armed to really convey their message. It wasn't a observer mentality. People really cared, and you could see that in the effort that had been taken with banners and flags and everything. And the third thing, as I mentioned before, the notice. All of this was done on very, very short notice. All those things considered, I think it was a brilliantly attended protest, and it filled me with pride.
So Mo G speaks there about the banners and the flares that were there. At Chelsea, they were throwing celery. Am I missing a joke there? That's
an old historic thing. That old-timers Chelsea fans.
There was people just lobbing celery at the police and throwing big bits of broccoli at each other. I'm thinking, am I missing the joke? Or I didn't get it at all. I didn't get it.
I take it you're trying to shoot. I mean, there was also
there was also
banners there as well, yeah, and blue boards.
No, there were. I just didn't know if I was missing the joke. I was like, why are they throwing celery everywhere?
The funny thing about it is celery had been actually banned for a few years because, like, a few of our like open top bus parades and something again that you haven't really had too much of. All right, like, people are throwing celery.
All right, you've had your quota of shots. All right, mate. Whatever. Marvin, we're joined by Marvin now. What are you saying, bro?
I'm good, fella. How you doing?
I'm all right, man. You need a trim badly. I mean, the trim wasn't, Marv, come on.
I'm letting it run loose now because...
I can see. You've gone too far.
Well, the thing is, it was combed and it was neat and I can show you photos, right? But then when it comes to the kids and you're rolling around on the floor, they're letting their hair go. I'm just letting it go. Do you know what I mean?
Marv, listen, you still look slicker than Jordan, all right? So you just ignore anything.
Wow! I mean, wow. Mo, it's good to see you, fella, but you know, stating the obvious is not how I want you to start.
I love it.
I mean, when I don't look better than George, that's when I retire, right? I mean, fair I play it. To you, George. Quite a few people messaged me with
I had a shave. Look,
you've been on the news quite a bit with the ESL and the final. So quite a few people that know that I know you have been like, "Is that your boy?" And I'm like, well, I know him. let's go, you know, firm acquaintance. Let's not make him my boy per se. But yeah, you've been doing the rounds. I saw you.
You know what, Marv? I was saying to G earlier on before we started recording. I was hoping to get a good few weeks of screen time out of this. The Channel 4 News. The bar for sport is so high. I've been there 9 years now. I think I can count on 4 occasions where sport has been the lead story.
Yeah.
Andy Murray winning Wimbledon.
Yeah.
England getting to the semi-final of the World Cup. I think Usain Bolt, one of the Olympics, was the lead story. And something grim like Barry.
So what are you saying? You wanted the ESL to last a bit longer?
Give me a couple of weeks, Marv. Just give me a couple of weeks. I don't want long, just a couple of weeks of screen time, 2 days. Pissed.
But how much, you know, if it's going to happen, I feel like, as you said, the bar's so high, so they would give you that couple of days. But if it was just happening over 2 weeks, they're not going to put you on every week because we'd just be like, ah, it's happening. It's not Brexit, George. It's just, it's rich clubs trying to make more money, right?
I could have squeezed a week out of it, but 2 days.
Yeah, fair. A week would be fair. But to be fair, between that and what was it, the Carabao final,
I've done all right.
You got noticed. Have you picked up some extra followers? some of the 60-plus grandmas sliding into your DMs.
They have. A couple have, you know. We'll chat offline about that one later on. Anyway.
There's me thinking Jordan wants to further his career. That's why he wants the airtime. He just wants his max DM sliding. That's what he wants.
You never, ever should have opened by trying to cuss Marv. He is destroying you.
I mean, anyway. Talking about my hair, like, I could cut that any time, though. His face is just there. That's why we're doing pods.
Anyway.
Sorry.
We've got quite a few guests coming on the pod today. I've just been speaking to Mo and G about last week. I don't want to focus too much on last week because it feels a little bit old hat now. But just generally, I've got the thoughts of a Chelsea and an Arsenal fan. As a United fan, just briefly and generally, what were your thoughts on the proposal and then collapse?
I mean, I probably will just say everything Mo and G said. At first, I was like bang against it. And overall, I've always been bang against it because, like some of the pundits said, I'm all about competition, right? And it just seemed like they were making it an exclusive club, which would have hampered the English football overall, not just English football, but a number of leagues. That being said, I thought Bamford was really eloquent. It just shows you when money's involved or when people really care about things, the way people can mobilise and galvanise said it all, right? Racism has never had that sort of movement, hence why you're not getting as much airtime as you want, George, right? So I think that it, you know, from the Prime Minister, and G and I've always talked about the Prime Minister, right? From the Prime Minister to all factions of football authorities across the land, everyone was out in uproar. Yeah, someone does something racist, they get a little fine and a slap on the wrist, right? So that being said, I also think the last point I'll make is, aside from racism, the level of hypocrisy, particularly from Sky, has not gone unnoticed, right? Because I actually, well, 2 points, right? And it's not just Sky, but I saw somebody's tweet and it would have meant nothing to lots of people, but it meant something to me, which was, once upon a time, the Champions League was on ITV. And that's when I truly started falling in love with football outside of the Premier League, when you saw those stars of Europe do it. And my family didn't have Sky. We didn't have cable. We watched it on ITV. We tuned in. You know, EastEnders took a back seat for us. And, you know, you forget that the youth today won't have that luxury unless parents are willing to allow them to stream illegally or spend ludicrous amounts on Sky. So the level of hypocrisy, particularly from Gary Neville and Carragher, I mean, now and again, they caught themselves and realised the whole inception of the Premier League was very similar. But
let me just sorry, cut you there, because Jamie Carragher did an interview with Owen Jones, the columnist for The Guardian. He's got a podcast out, and I watched it on Saturday, whatever, over the weekend. And he acknowledges that. He says, look, we were up in arms about this on Sky. We made our views very, very clear. But he did say, you know, but I'm a hypocrite. He did say I'm a hypocrite because fair. I make money from Sky. I make money from having these elite competitions. And I didn't understand why people were bashing Sky so much. Sky are trying to protect their business, right? They're looking at it like if these clubs go, the Premier League is less lucrative. That means it's less... It's watched by less.
It's positioning, Jude, right? They didn't say we're protecting our business. The way they galvanized it was, we need to rally and unite as a fan base for football, not for Sky. There's a difference. I think they just used particularly G's club as just pawns in their game of winning it. The fact that G told me or us that Chelsea say football was hilarious, because you know you don't get brownie points for lack of spine, G. Let's just put it like that, right? You're usually confined, you know, that's not a victory I think you can claim, right? But I take the point, right? And actually, one of the things that I thought was really interesting, you can see that Gary Neville and Carragher strategized on who was going to say what and when. And I think the most poignant bit was when Gary Neville said, it's only going to take one club. We just need one club to fall. Do you know what I mean? And it would all collapse. And this is exactly what he said. And, you know, it was out of Chelsea and City. I actually thought City would go first. But it happened. And, you know, now it's just Real Madrid probably still hanging around thinking that something could still come of the embers. I don't know.
I've got to shoot. But before I go, I'm going to leave you with one question about Sky Sports and Gary Neville and Jamie Carragher. Let's say, for example, Sky Sports were the lucky recipients of the TV rights for the European Super League. Would the coverage have been the same? On that note, I'm going to leave you and I'm going to go and break my fast. But listen, absolute pleasure.
Cheers for coming on, boss. One of you guys. Good to see you. Mate. Take care yourself, Mo. Big up. Peace.
Bye bye.
I think all that is interesting. I think we're kind of all on the same page, roughly. We're going to be speaking to Raphael Honigstein in a few minutes. Because one thing I'm interested to speak to him about is there's this kind of like fantasizing over this German model of fan ownership. And I get the merits of it. I understand why people like it. I get why fans want more of a say in their clubs. But I'm keen to hear the downsides of that as well, because I don't think it's as dreamy as we're all making it out to be.
you're close to the. Do you think it will ever come out, the three other clubs? Because Germany and France are getting patted on the back for, you know, abstaining from this ludicrous format, and I can't help but feel that German clubs and French clubs were involved, just not willing to stick their hands up. Probably even more spineless than G's guys, or have I got that wrong?
Well, I think that PSG didn't get involved because if you think about who owns PSG, the last thing they want, and this is why it was weird that Man City got involved, the last thing PSG want is to go up against FIFA. They've just been given a World Cup by FIFA. So the last thing you want to do is then... This is why I thought it was weird that they proposed this now, because I look at it like, just wait 18 months for the World Cup to come about and then do it anyway. Rafa's going to come in a second. We can ask Rafa in a second regarding the German clubs. I would hazard a guess that the fan base just wasn't having it.
I think there's some legal structures which actually stop German teams from doing it. So the fan ownership would mean that it'd be impossible to pull off. And, you know, without their say-so, and it was just never going to happen. So it was a non-flyer. Mm. So Bayern very smartly just sat back and didn't even get involved. But Rafa could confirm.
Yeah, let's hear from Rafa.
So right on cue, perfect timing. Mr. Raphael Honigstein, firm and football, German football and football expert on the pod once again. Cheers for joining us, Rafa. How are you doing, sir?
I'm very well. How are you?
We are good, man. We are very, very well. We are very well. I saw and heard your voice quite a lot last week, for obvious reasons. Have you had any downtime yet since the madness?
Not really. Not really. I mean, it just continues now. It's Nagelsmann going to Bayern, and it just doesn't stop this year.
So just on that note, just briefly, is that pretty much a done deal now?
It is.
Okay. It is, okay. Yes. Interesting, interesting. Okay. So Spurs can't get him. Not that they could have got him anyway, but I can fed up of hearing people talking about Nugs been going to Spurs. I'm like, no. That's not happening. Rafa, one thing that I wanted to ask you or talk to you about is... We've spoken that the three of us and Mo left us earlier on about last week, and I don't want to dwell too much on it because it's kind of come and gone for now anyway. But one of the things I'm hearing a lot about is the fact that we need to have more ownership from fans of our clubs in this country. The government are putting out a fan-led review in the next few weeks and months to try and ensure that what happened last week can never happen again, because these institutions of English heritage and history belong to the people, therefore the people should be the ones that have the biggest say. Look at Germany. Germany have a fan model ownership thing going on. It's great. The land of milk and honey. And I think while I get the appeal of having a bigger say as a fan in your club, talk to us a little bit about the downside of owning, of having that particular model. Because it can't all be great and amazing and perfect. Or am I wrong?
No, of course you're not wrong. I mean, there's a couple of downsides. One is, you know, democracy is messy. And when you have members in charge of the club, it can make for a very unsettled, difficult place. If you have lots of different opinions and if you have politics involved, and I want to get elected on the board, so I'll make promises, and maybe another faction has a different idea. I mean, that's exactly what happened at Schalke, for example, and Schalke going down. You know, Bundesliga 2, one of the huge teams in German football, a similar thing happened to Hamburg. Not necessarily because of the model, but when you have those structures that are a little bit, you know, unsettled and open to outside pressure and people, you know, being very wary of how things play because they want to hold on to their position, things can get a little bit tricky. And there's a reason why a lot of these traditional clubs with those traditional structures have struggled, because decision-making progress is not very streamlined, and in a globalized football world, some of them have struggled to adjust with that model, because the model, if you will, is the same model that any other club in Germany, you know, stamp collectors club, pigeon breeders club, hobby, I don't know, fetish, sadomasochistic neighborhood club, they all have to organize along these democratic structures in order to call yourself a club in Germany. There are very strict rules. You have to have elections and all these things. And football, in a way, hasn't really adjusted and is still being run along these structures at many places. That's the problem number one. Problem number two is, because the ownership model effectively makes it very difficult for outside investors to get in and take control, they can buy minority shares, but not many oligarchs or nation states or American hedge funds want to be minority shareholder in the Bundesliga club with members deciding what's going on. So effectively it acts as a bar to outside investment. That then means that those clubs who got it right and who do very well find it easier to hold on to that advantage and cement their position. And there is no Chelsea's coming in. There's no Manchester City's coming in. There's no clubs like even Arsenal, you know, to do what they have done in a very short period of time would have been a lot more difficult in Germany with the very organic way of doing things. Organic, you know, organic growth is great, but it takes a long, long time. And that is the downside to this model. And I think it'd be very difficult, if not impossible, to go to England, where clubs have been run as companies for hundreds of years, and say, right, you're no longer a company. You're now a club controlled by the members. We'll have elections for the chairman, and we'll still somehow think or want to, at the same time, attract all the cash coming in. You can't really have it both ways, I think, because money doesn't want necessarily democratic, messy structures. Money wants owners and easy decisions.
So on that last point, and G and Marvin, chip in if you have any kind of questions as well. On that last point, am I right in saying then that one of the downside also is that, because I noticed that Bayern and Dortmund, the two massive clubs, in Germany, they never spend crazy money on transfer fees. You never see a 60, 70, 80 million pound player going to those two clubs. Is that because they don't have a Roman Abramovich? They don't have a billionaire owner that owns the entire club that can make that sort of investment in one particular player. Arsenal, for example, they're talking about wanting the fan base. I'm talking about now. They want what Bayern have got. And I'm saying that's great, but then don't expect there to be an Aubameyang or a Lacazette or a high profile expensive signing, because the chances are the money's going to be less. Is that a fair representation of another downside of not having a billionaire single owner?
Well, Sorry, that's to Rafa. Marvin,
pick up after Rafa answers.
Not necessarily. I mean, Bayern are run along the Arsenal model. They have different owners or no owners, but they're run as a self-sustainable club and they can only spend the money that they generate.
Okay.
But like Arsenal, they generate a lot of money. I mean, Bayern turn over about 700 million euros. Arsenal in the Champions League are not that far behind. Then the question is, what do you do with that money? I mean, we have had an 80 million euro buy at Bayern in Lucas Hernandez. You've had an 80 million euro buy with Pepe. Nicolas Pepe. Might not have looked like an 80 million euro player. But the differences aren't that vast between those clubs of that size. The bigger issue is when you go down a couple of levels, when you go to a Frankfurt or Stuttgart, you know, huge clubs, but who can only grow with the money that they generate themselves through success on the pitch.
Okay.
What happened in England was that people have come in and said, okay, let's not wait for this club to grow. We're just going to put some money in, help the club grow, and then the success is going to come. And Germany is still the other way around. You have to be really successful, make lots of right decisions, get into the Champions League many, many times, like Dortmund have done over the last 10 years, and then you can grow. So that's what I said earlier. It's very difficult to do it along those lines because it's very organic.
Okay. Sorry, go on, Marv.
No, I mean, Rafa will correct me, right? But I mean, part of me is really impressed with the German model and the fan ownership, because part of me just thinks the Prem is just crazy with fees and transfers and wages. It's the Wild West. But then from what I understand of the German league, it almost makes it very difficult to topple Bayern, because Rafa, I think they command the majority of the TV rights, and the way that the money is apportioned is very different to how the Premier League do it, right? So, like, no disrespect to Bayern, I love their model, but they're very dominant, and somehow they're also able to purchase. Why you're not seeing those big fees is because I always get the feeling they're able to purchase the top talent from other German clubs at a reasonable price, right? And it's almost like, you know, the rest of the Bundesliga sometimes appears to me as a sort of feeder for Bayern to then dominate in Europe. So it depends how you look at it, right? But I do feel that, you know, fan ownership is never a bad thing, because the one thing that's come out of everything that we've seen is, you know, the fans should come first, right? They'll support the teams through rain or shine, and owners come and go based on when they're ready to sell. So I think having fan ownership, and it always makes me laugh that Chelsea can't do anything with their stadium, mainly because of that sort of fan element in terms of ownership, right? So I'm not against more ownership, but I also would take the Bundesliga with a pinch of salt, because from what I see, it's functionality supports Bayern in a way that I haven't seen in other leagues.
I don't think you can entirely blame the system for that, because if you look at Italy, for example, where you have very similar situation with Juventus, there it's a very open system. You have investors, you have people who bought Milan, you have people who bought Roma, you have people who bought Inter, but it just haven't been very well run. And Juventus, who are run in a very old school sort of parochial way, have been smart and won nine in a row. So it's not necessarily a system that breeds these monopolies. But what is true is that we have effectively a monopoly, and it's very difficult for anyone to do anything about it as long as fan ownership makes it difficult. I mean, why have RB Leipzig been able to sort of turbocharge their rise through the leagues and become the second best or maybe third best team in Germany and get to the semi-final of the Champions League? Because effectively they have circumvented the system. They pay lip service to it. They have members, they have elections, but everyone knows the club is really run by a soft drinks company and everything else is just a facade. That's why we had a lot of resistance in Germany against this model, because people realized that this is a sham. But of course, it's very well done. It's very successful. So I guess the neutrals turn a blind eye. One more word on Bayern. I think you're right. They put themselves in a position where it's not so much the wage, the fees, but it's the wages. Because they can blow anyone out of the water wages-wise, and you can almost guarantee trophies, it then becomes a situation where the sort of Real Madrid and Barcelona rolled into one. If you are a German footballer, you go to Bayern, you know you're going to be the best paid, you're going to be looked after as far as your chances for the national team is concerned, and you have a realistic chance of playing in the Champions League latter stages. So it's kind of a no-brainer. And I think the Bundesliga needs more competition. But this is my last point. This is a really interesting thing where it's fundamentally different to English football. And maybe English football is changing in the wake of the Super League. But you will find very, very few people on the ground who dream of their club being owned by Saudi Arabia or a rich factory owner or a hedge fund.
I'd gamble, Rafa. I'm not going to lie. At this time now, I'd gamble on it.
I'm talking more of the principle.
I'm joking.
Even,
and you're talking about less desperate people as well.
Jordan. If you talk to somebody in Stuttgart or Frankfurt or Werder Bremen, you know, clubs who have all won big things, but are now not competitive or not certainly at Bayern's level, and say, you could have the best owner in the world. He's going to bankroll you. He's going to do what Manchester City have done. He's going to, you know, transform the city and do everything. They will say no, because the need for them to still feel that this is their club, that they're somehow in control of it, that this is not just a consumer relationship that you have if you're completely without any real input, is worth more to these people than the chance to be competitive. And that's something that I think is really important to understand from a kind of Anglo-Saxon view, because yes, the system Germany is leads to distortions and it's definitely not perfect, but people don't want it any other way. And unless that changes, people are happier to put up with that rather than to sell everything.
This fan ownership model, that wouldn't be good for your club, would it? Because you guys seem to love Roman. He loves the club. He's a Chelsea fan now, blah, blah.
Yeah, it is fan ownership.
Touche. I like that one. But the idea of one man paying whatever it takes to get success on the pitch, you're quite cool with that, are you? You wouldn't necessarily.
And the thing is, I mean, Chelsea are in quite a good place where, I mean, people always say when Roman goes, you're actually finished. But he's actually put a good infrastructure in there. The only thing he didn't get over the line was the stadium, because we know like Boris and all them have fitted him up. But if he got the stadium over the line as well, I think the infrastructure was actually there to be self-sufficient. But I would be a hypocrite. I'd be a Jamie Carragher if I was to go and say, no, you can't do it now for other clubs. And I think it's been really good. Like, I think if you look at the way City have come and they've done it, they've learned a bit from our mistakes. Their PR has been a little bit better. And they've really added something to the league. So I would never want a time where that couldn't happen to a certain extent. Like, I wouldn't want that club to then come in and then recreate the Super League, for instance. But I don't mind people coming in, investing, and then being competitive at the top. In fact, I look forward to the next City, because I think it makes the league better.
Gee, you've got about 7 million players out on loan, and then you're bigging up infrastructure.
That's a part of our infrastructure.
it's enough,
but it is.
Yeah, I mean, I just disagree with it fundamentally, right? I think it's complete lunacy. And, you know, to be honest, I haven't met a lot of Roman naysayers, right? I find it amazing that everybody's so in love with a man that you barely hear from, right? Or never hear from, even in the face of the adversity we have. He's just, you're silent, your imaginary silent best friend, right? So
All a part of his mystery, Marv.
Gee, we're not talking about Dr. Claw and Inspector Gadget here. We're talking about ownerships of clubs, right? Like, I'm okay with a lack of mystery. I'd like to know who owns my club, but I hear what you're saying.
Let me bring in, we're now joined by Neil from the Anfield Wrap, big, big Liverpool fan. Good evening, Neil. How are you?
I'm very good, Jordan. How are you doing?
I'm really, really good, thank you. We've discussed earlier on the debacle that was last week. So and I'm sure your thoughts will be the same as ours. So we don't want to kind of go over that too much. But what I do want to ask you before I kind of get to the question of fan ownership with regarding Liverpool and whether you're for that or not, is just briefly, what are your thoughts on towards Liverpool in terms of what they tried to do last week? And I asked Mo, an Arsenal fan earlier on, if he'd lost a little bit of love for his club based on what they tried to do. Or do you just think this is business, it was going to happen anyway?
Now, I'll ask a sidebar as well, Neil. Did you get to have your drink? Because I know you're reading that. not yet, no?
We'll get to Liverpool on the pitch later on.
I think he's been having a lot of drinks, but not celebratory.
That one, Marv, not a big one. There is, first and foremost, did I think it was going to happen anyway? In a sense, sort of, yes. I think it's a direction of travel. I think you've got too many clubs who are at different sort of phases of crises points. And then you've got too many factors that people are trying to sort of offset all over the place. I think it showed an inability to work within existing structures and with existing sort of forces, which is a real shame from Liverpool's point of view, because I think I've long thought that would be Liverpool's smartest way to do it, would actually be to show genuine leadership. In terms of what Liverpool want to see happen, they're in a position, they're not now, along with Fenway Sports Group, in a position to show genuine leadership and to build consensus across much of the football pyramid. And across the last 12 months, they've basically completely and utterly sacrificed all of that capital that they might have had to be able to make the sort of changes that would, I think, benefit both the game and, to an extent, the people who own Liverpool. In terms of love for the club, quite the opposite in a sense, in that the manager's gone out of his way to be very, very clear on when we're talking about the club, what do we mean? I thought it was impossible, certainly whilst he wasn't playing a game of competitive football, for me to think any more of Jordan Henderson than I already did. But Jordan Henderson, in every single way, has shown a staggering amount of leadership and, frankly, an excellent PR game with a good graphic design aesthetic that has something to recommend it. And he's shown yet again that he is, in a really strange way, and I don't entirely understand how it's happened, he's almost like the captain of the captains in this bizarre sort of world that we've ended up in. Henderson's leadership is staggeringly better than the people who own Liverpool. And I think that what's important, and it's always been a bit like this at Liverpool, and it always will be, is that the ownership is the ownership, the club is the club, and they're two quite separate things. That's a massive part of the coming out the other side of the Hicks and Gillette stuff as well. The ownership, even when it was David Moores, the ownership's the ownership and the club's the club. So in terms of love for the club, my answer is genuinely no. It's not made any real sort of substantial difference at all. In terms of, I think the best thing we can do with these rich men is point and laugh at them. I think that there's nothing that rich men are more scared of than being pointed at and laughed at. And every single one of these rich men who own these football clubs, and let's be honest, they are all men and they are only talking to men. Every single one of these rich men who own and run these football clubs should be genuinely pointed and laughed at this stage of proceedings, because they've tried to act as though they have this unbelievable power to remake the world along the lines that they see. And what they've been shown is the staggering nature of their own inadequacies, and they should be reminded of them at every opportunity.
Mm. And I was just talking to Rafa earlier on about the German model of fan ownership. What are your thoughts on the talk now, and the government are talking tough about getting through some kind of legislation that enables all clubs to have some element of fan ownership? I think in principle, and to be fair, in Germany, we're seeing it can be a success and it can be great, and I'm for it. But Rafa's laid out some reasons he wouldn't have heard, obviously, but why it's not. It can be difficult, can be messy, and it can actually lead to some kind of destruction and fraction within a football team.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of aspects to this. The one thing I will keep my eye on right now is that ultimately the thing that needs to be reformed that is easy for the UK government, English government, whichever way you want to phrase it, to reform is the relationship between the Premier League and its fans, and the relationship between the Premier League and the pyramid. And the Premier League clubs, all 20 of them, and specifically the 14 who weren't involved in the breakaway, will be absolutely fucking terrified of that. Absolutely fucking terrified of that. So they've played a blinder this week in terms of PR. They went straight to Downing Street. They knew what they were doing, the Premier League 14. I expect a lot of this stuff, everyone's going to hope it's going to disappear so it can be swept under the carpet. Right now, the Premier League takes 92% of broadcast revenue in this country. The bottom 14 in the Premier League take, and let me be crystal clear on this, 9 times as much television money as all 24 championship clubs. That's just the bottom 14. That doesn't count the top six. The last thing that the Premier League want to see happen is actually genuine reform of ownership models and also of the way in which the money moves through the pyramid. Mm. So the thing to watch right now is everyone's going to try and get the genie of the last week back into the bottle, because the theory will be everyone's done the job that it was needed to be done. But the last thing anybody wants to do is, for instance, make this point that if you were to take 1% of the Premier League broadcast income and give it to every League Two club and spread it out equally, all of their television revenues over the course of a year will go up by 200%, 200% club by club. That's currently how unequal this pyramid is. We're in a situation at the minute where Norwich are first and Watford are second in the Championship. They come straight back up. What then happens to that parachute payment money that's earmarked? It doesn't go to the EFL for the EFL to decide where it should be spent. It stays within the Premier League clubs. Right now, the parachute payment system works perfectly for the Premier League, and it works against the interests of the EFL. No one is reforming any of these things if the Premier League 14 have anything to say about it. And I think that, you know, I'll say it again, they played an absolute blinder. An absolute blinder across the course of the week, the Premier League 14. They should be praised for their excellent public relations and the fact that they read the situation far better than the 12 aforementioned clubs. So I think that, you know, ultimately they ought to be praised for that. But what happens is that you, for instance, end up in a situation where the Today programme on Radio 4 gets Christian fucking Perslow on as a neutral expert to offer his expertise and his insight and his wisdom without understanding that he's a runner and rider in this game, and that he's a man who in the past has disparaged fans who protested against ownerships of clubs, but he gets to turn up and be the voice of fucking reason. Absolutely despicable. Bad journalism. But the point is that they get away with that bad journalism because they just got out ahead of the story and they did an excellent job. Fan ownership, therefore, I think, or fans on the board, I think there's lots of theoretical stuff around the fan on the board. I wouldn't want it to be me at Liverpool, I'll tell you that for nothing. I think all these models that we talk about, if we were living in a proper world, what we could do is we could say, all right, a fan on a board, let's pick 6 clubs from across the pyramid and trial it for 2 years and report back with our findings. 50+1, let's pick 6 clubs and do 50+1 and come back and trial it with our findings. And then we'll work out what works for what type of club and go from there and pick another couple of models within their socio-membership stuff and begin to get a bit of data as to what can and can't happen in England. We sadly don't live in that world because that a level of consideration and there being structures to pursue that sort of consideration, they're non-existent. In English political life and in English sporting life, they're non-existent. You know, we want to talk about an independent regulator. That could be something an independent regulator could do. But there is no way the Premier League, all 20 clubs, all 14, all 6, will allow a genuine, powerful independent regulator to come in and step in. Or if they will, it will be over their dead bodies. And what you're not going to have, a Conservative government views regulation in the same way a dog views a bicycle. It knows it gets humans round quicker, but it doesn't know how the fuck it works. So we're not going to have a situation where all of a sudden the Conservatives are going to step in and say, this is all the regulation this thing needs for it to be able to function better. They're not going to do that. So genuinely, the idea of the fan stepping in and doing X, Y, or Z, whether or not it's an inherent good, I think is debatable, but we're not going to get the data to debate it properly unless there is an unbelievable sea change at the top of English football and the top of British political life.
Rafa, let me just ask you, what's been the reaction across... Well, do you know the reaction across Europe to what happened here in England? Because it's seen as English fans, stop this happening. Yay, Chelsea, Arsenal, Liverpool. They turned up at their stadiums and their training grounds. And they're the reason, the passion of English fans, are the reason that European football has been saved. What's the vibe on the streets of Europe? Not that you frequent these streets in the last week or so. But are you hearing?
I haven't been outside the UK in 6 months now. I can't get away anymore. I mean, I wouldn't mock it. I think there was genuine admiration in lots of places, including places like Italy and Spain, where perhaps certainly in Spain, where there isn't the same sort of fan engagement. And it might have only been a minority factor in things falling apart, but I wouldn't underestimate it, especially at a club like Chelsea, where Abramovich is not there to rile the fans. He's not there to have people chanting outside Stamford Bridge saying, my club is doing something bad. That's not his game plan. So that public show was important. And, you know, every revolution, every counter-revolution needs its images. And that is one of the iconic images of the Super League, is people in Corona times having some kind of mix between a protest and a street party. But of course, much more important structurally, if you will, was the reaction of the Premier League. And that was always, I felt, the weakest link in this. By getting six English teams on board, the Super League basically was born dead, because very quickly the Premier League realized what perhaps the six clubs themselves hadn't fully understood, is that that league, if it comes off the ground, kills the Premier League as a competition. And when that was, you know, apparent, then government and the FA and the Premier League and all the other clubs who weren't directly involved all clubbed together with a lot of support from grassroots and from the media, and made sure that this thing doesn't get off the ground. So I think it was important to have that show of protest, especially because, you know, we haven't been used to people actually congregating in a football context and singing songs and having a good time, or at least making a stand. And I think it felt very, very powerful as a result.
Just final question on this. I mean, we'll get to football stuff in a second. Why wasn't Bayern involved in this? Or were they?
Well, I mean, Bayern were involved in previous discussion. This is not a new thing. The Super League has been around as a concept for many years. And back in 2016, Bayern themselves, as was revealed by the Football League's data, they were actually looking into it. They were trying to figure out, can we leave the Bundesliga? Is that possible if the Super League comes off? They eventually decided against it. They also had very strong internal opposition, if you will, but people on the board who said, this is never going to happen. We cannot do this. The Bundesliga would kill us. Our fans would kill us. So, you know, whether it's consideration for the fans or fear is a way of, you know, is a matter of interpretation. But I think the bottom line is that they were very aware of the fallout, and they knew that they could not do it. As much as they might have secretly liked the idea of taking 300 million euros guaranteed every year from a Super League, to do so at the destruction of the Bundesliga, because there would have been collateral damage, to do so in opposition of their fans and of everyone else, even Bayern, who tend to ride roughshod over concerns from other people and sort of don't really care if they polarize opinion, they knew that this would be not just one, but a couple of steps too far. And that's why they and Dortmund never got involved. And that's why the Super League people themselves were careful not to include them too closely, because they knew as soon as Bayern and Dortmund would be part of this, even of the discussion, they would probably, either through just the hesitation or through their more direct opposition, undermine the whole project. That's why it was all conspiratorial. That's why it was all, you know, only a very small circle of people. As soon as Bayern and Dortmund are in it and they're not in it, then the momentum is already stopped, because you have two clubs are saying, not sure. We have to ask the members. The members will probably say no. So it was never going to work in these circumstances.
I think on the Bayern thing, I think that, you know, from a Liverpool point of view, there was four things I would argue that Fenway Sports Group ultimately wanted from it. One was more money. Two was more of a guarantee around the money vis-a-vis Champions League qualification. Well, everyone had like more money, but from Bayern's point of view, them and arguably Real and Barca are about as certain of playing Champions League football every other season that you possibly need anyway, within reason. It would have to be something pretty horrendous to hit Bayern to knock that off. Greater financial controls around spending is obviously a concern of Bayern's, but they're nowhere near as implicated year on year by that as Liverpool are, because Liverpool are a Premier League club and they've got to deal with City and Chelsea being able to inflate the market in a domestic sense every single year. Bayern's policy, as far as I can see, and it doesn't look like it's changing anytime soon, is to buy the best of the German league and to go from there. And they appear to be doing that really, really well. There might be one or two exceptions like Haaland, which could do them in. And then the other thing as well is ability to sort of market around their own media rights, which I think is a big thing for Liverpool, and it's something that Liverpool have had their eye on. And even for, you know, right on in a rights-based conversation, Munich in a German context, it's a massive market and they've got a lot of control of that market. So there's still positives, the idea of getting involved there, e.g. the more money and a general sense of trying to keep European spending under control. but the wants and needs are nowhere near as urgent. The really strange thing about it all is that a lot of what drives this in terms of its urgency is what Madrid and Barcelona need because of how dreadfully they've been run over a period of time. And you can say a similar thing, I would say, around Juventus, given the fact that Juventus have had the keys to the kingdom and have absolutely made a complete hash of it, as you sort of see in this season. The really strange thing from a Liverpool point of view is that it's not the same wants and needs. They're not as panicked by any of those things, but they would like the controls around spending. I think if you said to Liverpool, you can have one thing, there'd be a part of that I'd want the extra money. But I think the controls around spending still remains a really key thing for Fenway Sports Group, because I think they feel as though they can box everything else off themselves over a period of time to a degree, being able to leverage Liverpool in a number of different ways. Mm. And I think that that's still going to be a live runner and rider within English football, is how we control spending in general. And a lot of it's going to have to be a change in supporter mindset if it is indeed to happen. And if it doesn't happen, then we're a ticking clock away from this happening again. So I take Gabriel's point before, and a lot of Chelsea supporters love Abramovic and et cetera, et cetera. But if you don't want a Super League, you want your owners to spend less money. If you don't want a Super League, if you decide that you think that that's a real, real problem, then what we're all going to have to accept is that, not that spending stops, but that it's going to have greater control around what can and can't be spent and when.
Last question for you, Raf, and I'll let you go. I promise I'll only keep you here for a brief period. As the representative of Jurgen Klopp in this country, I'll get Neil's thoughts and the boys' thoughts on Liverpool season in just a minute. Actually, we've not discussed Liverpool since I think all you guys were on the pod last time. How much responsibility do you think Klopp has to take in Liverpool's, and I put poor, depending on how you look at it, their poor season? We know about the injuries, we know about COVID, we know that City have come back with a vengeance, but there doesn't seem to be, for me, much scrutiny on some decisions that he's taken as their football manager this season as to why they are where they are. Am I being harsh?
Well, first of all, I'm happy that you asked me don't ask me how much responsibility I'm taking. As your representative in the UK, and I want to add, I'm not his representative. He would not like me to represent him. He's got very capable people to do that.
Of course.
I think it's never just one thing. I think it's never just bad buys. It's never just bad luck. There's always factors involved. And I think if you ask him and his coaching staff to go through all the games, what mistakes they've made, or what mistakes perhaps they made going into the season, thinking that the team that they had was good enough to support a title race, they would probably reevaluate and said, we got it wrong. We shouldn't have trusted Gomez and Matip with their injury record. We should have at least gone out and buy one big center back to supplement the team. The problem is, you know, that's still in the realms of theory. If that guy then gets injured, just like the other guys did, and including Fabinho, then you're still stuck with a really ridiculous situation where you have four centre-backs out plus your fifth deputy centre-back out. I think it showed that, and I wouldn't see that as a criticism, more as a, simply as a matter of fact, I think it shows that Klopp's football is perhaps, unlike Guardiola's football, much more dependent on the team playing with a certain sense of rhythm and energy. And if that rhythm and energy isn't there, you don't have these intricate, finely tuned, amazing patterns that City have, that they seem to be able to play independent of personnel, independent whether fans are in the stadium or not, injuries, doesn't matter, Kevin De Bruyne is out, it doesn't really matter. I think with Liverpool, it's perhaps a slightly more volatile team, that if you take one of those factors away, if you take away some of the energy, and that midfield is overplayed and it don't quite have the same drive, if you take away the security at the back and then maybe the people up front are not quite sure how to press, then things, I think, are more vulnerable and fragile than we perhaps anticipated. Can you change it? I'm not sure. You know, I was having a discussion with Pete Kravitz, his number two, 4 years ago, 2017. I asked him, you know, a lot of people are saying you play nice football, but in order to win something, you have to have a number nine. You have to have a big, strong guy up front, because in January and February, everyone's tired. And maybe you need somebody who's just going to be there and just score from a corner or from a long ball. And, you know, maybe this idea with these three, you know, forwards who are all wingers or number 10s, maybe it's not right for the Premier League. And he thought, he looked at me and said, yeah, but this is our idea and we're not going to change. We don't have this idea that suddenly in January we're just going to start lumping the ball up front to a big number nine, because maybe that will help us. So they have a plan, and I think the plan has been exposed, like all plans, as not foolproof. Whether I'd see that as a criticism, I'm not sure in the grand scheme of things, but I think it just shows you that it's fallible and not foolproof. But then few managers, few teams would have been able to cope with what Liverpool endured this season and still come out at the very top. They have been short of their best, but I think there are reasons for that. And I find it difficult to say Klopp made this mistake or that mistake. Maybe I'm not exactly objective, but I'd find it really difficult to point a finger at one or two specifics that he got wrong.
Listen, Rafa, cheers for coming on, man. I said I'd keep you 10 minutes. You've been on for half an hour. Thank you very much.
Just because of Neil.
Yeah, I know. I said to Neil, you've got 10 minutes.
Rafa. No, always me. You said to me, you've got 10 minutes. You brought me on at 8:45.
I know.
I think we're looking at timekeeper here. You're up there with a Premier League referee.
Listen, it's been a really good discussion and fun. So
thank you very much, Rafa.
Time flies when the conversation is.
That's what I think. Nice one, Rafa. Cheers, bye. Take care, mate. Take care. Bye. Same question to you guys. I'll come to you last, Neil. G and Marvin, am I being harsh on saying that Klopp needs to take some responsibility in some decisions that he's made this season as to why Liverpool are where they are? Or it's just been one of those really bad seasons where it's bigger than him?
George, you're always looking to give people accountability apart from yourself.
What have I done?
George, every year that someone doesn't win the league, whoever doesn't win the league, it's like, oh, there should be more pressure on Pep. That's
he finished like 55 points behind Liverpool, G.
But he was second and he got to Champions League semi-final. You know what I mean? Every year, whoever doesn't win the league, George wants them sacked. You know what I mean?
I didn't say sacked. I didn't say whoa. I didn't say sacked.
You don't say sacked, but you articulate it so well. Should the fans be asking questions? Should the pressure be up? You know what I mean, G? There's always an agenda of whoever doesn't win it.
Unlike you two, and I get why, I actually really like Jurgen Klopp. I really like him.
I like Klopp too.
No, I don't dislike him, but you know how I stand on Liverpool.
I do. Yeah, but my point is, me liking him and praising him for the job that he's done at Liverpool in the last 3 years in particular, I think now's a time when things are going wrong, where he can't be absolved just because we like him of all responsibility. George, I get the injuries, I get COVID, I get City are just really good. But, you know, there's no scrutiny, no?
George, he's had one below par season. What? And a season that was on...
I'm not saying Klopp out!
Probably on par with... Like, when he arrived, the season that they're having now is pretty normal for Liverpool as well. I think he's bought himself at least another season.
Jude, can I just say, I was with G up until he started backing Klopp as passionately as he did. And that's not because I love Klopp, right? But I think, and my memory might be struggling here, but many, many moons ago when the four of us could be in a studio and chat, Neil said a lot of stuff. And then the last time we were on the pod, I think we were goading Neil. We were saying, what will you take, Phil Jones? And Neil was like, I will take anyone. And I think we were in the midst of either just beginning the window or we were in the window. And that's the bit where I would point the finger at Klopp, right? Because I think you guys are spot on. I think it's been a freak season for Liverpool at centre-back. But the window was open. There were defenders there of a higher calibre to be bought if the money was there. And I think he would have found it. And I don't think he pulled the trigger correctly, right? And, you know, I know you've got, you know, other people in the Liverpool hierarchy that have a say. But I think if Klopp said, you know, Gomez and Van Dijk aren't going to be here for the rest of the season, go out and get me X, right? And by X, I mean people that I don't have to Google. That might have changed things slightly, right? I think it's been difficult for them. And I think it highlights the importance of, in particular, Virgil van Dijk. And it's just a freak season where the front three that took everybody's breath away last year, well, Firmino aside, just stuttered, and you know, the wheels started to fall off. So you can't blame Klopp for everything, but I do point to the fact that the centre-back challenge was not new. Van Dijk was lost early in the season, and I don't think the recruitment was there, right? But other than that, I agree with G. Like, if you're insinuating that, you know, the pressure cooker should be turned up.
I never said that.
Somebody that brings a title back to Liverpool. Fair enough, Neil didn't get an open top bus, but the title's still with Liverpool. So that's where I stand on it.
Am I being really harsh, Neil?
I think that you can always say, could the manager have done differently, done better, done something a bit alternative? I think that that's fine, and I think it's valid. And you can go back to the start of the season. You know, I think Liverpool let Dejan Lovren go and replace him with a Greek left-back whose name I can barely remember for around the same amount of money that we sold him for, because he's not, I don't think he's played a minute of Premier League football yet, or if he has, he hasn't played more than 10. So I think that there's a couple of questions around that. But for years, Liverpool supporters, for instance, were saying things like, well, we've got to cover left-back. We've got to get left-back covering. Liverpool supporters who decided that Dejan Lovren should never kick a ball for Liverpool again, he now finds himself captain of Zenit St. Petersburg. I'd point out Dejan Lovren. There is in general, I think, you know, Liverpool, I think, do leave themselves a little bit understocked at the heart of the defence. And I think that was a gamble that they took, and they could not have been punished more. It's as though, you know, it wasn't as though they put all the money on double six. You know, they put all the money on doubles and everything over four and managed to roll double one and two. It's fair to say that's where they've left themselves, I think, their heads. So they've been unfortunate.
Sorry, Neil, to cut you there. Just I'll let you finish. Yeah. But my criticism isn't even so much of the transfers and who he let go and who he didn't bring in. I'm more talking about in-game management decisions, tactics. Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
I feel as though in-game management substitutions is mostly what people mean around that. And he's got a bit of grief the weekend around that. And just as an example on it. But Klopp makes the changes he makes. Newcastle have a shot on 55. They don't have another shot until 91. But because the ball ends up hitting the back of the net, you know, if it ends up being, well, could he have made or should he have made different changes? I feel a little bit at times like we act as though substitutions should all work from the outside looking in. And certainly when you're dealing with an elite club and an elite manager, like every single one of them is meant to be a hit. And that's just not quite the case. A lot of the times as well, managers, when they don't make a sub, they'll get criticised. But in the act of not making a decision, as people perceive it, they're actually making a decision that I'm all right with what I can see. And I want more of what I can see, and I don't want someone to come in and look to do this. I think there's been times where Klopp's in-game management has been good. There's been times where I'd say it's been bad. There's been moments, Liverpool were brilliant last season at half times. Liverpool would always come out second half, look better, look stronger, look faster, look smarter more than anything else. This season, I think Liverpool have been less good at half times. Is that something that Klopp and his team have got to sort of analyse and look at? Is it as simple as personnel? Is it as simple as the fact that the players aren't quite as on it for whatever reason? And if that's the case, that ultimately comes back to the manager. What I would say is I think Liverpool are really good at review. So I think that what we've seen since Klopp's come in is Liverpool are really good at having an idea, having a course of action, and are really good at reviewing that. I don't think they're necessarily that good at reviewing that as seasons wear on. I think they're good at reviewing at the end of a season to work out what we need to do better for next season. We keep what works. We shed everything else. And I think that there's history in that. So I'd expect there'll be no more stringent review process as to what's gone wrong this season than the one that happens internally within the club. They'll look at everything. They'll look at every game. They'll already have some stuff sort of worked out as to what should have been different. And they'll be making some decisions around it. But elsewhere, you know, I think that they may have been a little slow. If I've got a criticism, I think there's a point, and I think it comes a lot earlier than Liverpool supporters think, and a lot earlier than Liverpool's players think. And I'd love to know where Liverpool's management end up. But there was a point in this where this season was just about hanging on to top four for dear life. And I think Liverpool don't work that out culturally and collectively until, I would say, deep into February. And I think that that's a little bit too late. And I think that, and that goes for supporters as well. Like I was saying before we play Leicester, I was going on our shows and I was saying a draw is fine, you know, and people were saying we should beat them. And I was going, they're above us in the table. And if we stop them from getting 3 points and we just get one each, a draw is fine. And you actually see in that game, you know, when it goes 1-1, Liverpool are determined to go up the other end straight away and score. Liverpool maybe just needed to cut the losses on the season a little bit earlier. But then
you're making the point that they should have actually forgotten the title and focused on just finished top four. Earlier on, okay.
What United have done brilliantly through the season. United have been great at playing the situation that's in front of them. United, you think about the number of poor games United have been involved in that were inevitably going to become draws from some distance out, but it stopped the other side from getting 2 points, and United backed themselves against the poorer sides. Liverpool have been dreadful against the poorer sides, and that's a lot of that's to do with the finishing. But what they've also not done is just get through mucky periods in games by being alehouse and kill the game off. Just be absolutely horrible for a period of time. Just suffer for 10 minutes. I think that's difficult because you've got a team of champions. You know, they're on the back-to-back of a European Cup win and then a league win. So they're a team of champions who believe they should be playing champion football. But there was a period of time, I would argue, in January, in February, where Liverpool went into a load of games where a point would have been fine. And the mentality was win at all costs. And then, you know, things like when they go 1-0 down against Brighton, they play like the minus one, if you see what I mean. Because they've gone 1-0 down, they're so desperate to win. It would have been fine to, you know, there's a few of those games where just get out with a draw, and then we worry about it later. So take your medicine. It can't go for you at the minute. You're really suffering. Just take your medicine. And I think that was something which maybe they'll look back on and think, could we have just at times took our medicine a bit earlier in some of these games, accepted 1 point when it was all that was there for us, but then made sure in the games that mattered we were getting over the line. Brighton's a bad example, but you take me point.
Yeah, I get you. Just final one, gents. Today, the first two members of the Hall of Fame for the Premier League was announced. Alan Shearer and Titi Henry, my boy.
Why are you saying it like that? You sound really sarcastic.
No. I'm not. I'm excited about it.
Are you?
Maybe excited is a stretch, but it's something interesting.
Is it because you got some kind of award for something? Is that your trophy for the season?
Listen, I'll take it. I'm taking it. Arsenal's Thierry Henry. All three of you guys, who were the next two players you would like to see added next? Let me start with you, Marvin.
Well, can I just say that I am I the only one that thinks Ryan Giggs' name got discreetly etched off the list as due to current events, right? Because even the way the list was published, it was kind of imbalanced the wrong way around. So I thought that was quite interesting. But for me, I think the list was good. What I also find comical, Jordan, is we criticise the European Super League and the US owners, yet we bring in a typically US thing, i.e. the Hall of Fame in, right? Which is everything that the US have done for many years and love it. But back to your question, you just want two because they wanted six, right? They wanted the fans themselves are going to vote for six out of the 23.
Sorry. I thought it was the first two.
Oh, I don't know if they're going to... I think we vote for six. I don't know how many actually go in of that six, but I know the vote will be six. Okay. I mean, if you want my two and you want me to put bias aside, because if I was putting bias in, you know, Andrew Cole would be in there. I've always been a fan. I would probably go...
I was with him on Sunday, actually. I was hanging out with him on Sunday.
Did he mention me? I've got a picture of him, you know.
give me
proper
a team
fanboy,
name.
G. Give me G, a team. Proper fanboy.
Proper groupie. Yeah,
no. Did he ask for me? You just said that on a podcast.
I would put, and this is going to surprise a few, but if I was putting somebody just on impact, I would probably go Ashley Cole and Steven Gerrard as my two. Ashley Cole for me is the best fullback. You know what? I can't put Gerrard in. I can't. I tried. he never even won a league. So I'll put in Ashley Cole and Roy Keane as my two. I've really tried to sound like I'm not biased, but I can't. I can't put Gerrard in. So Roy Keane and Ashley Cole would be my two, Jord.
That's mad because they're my two as well.
I mean, I've been having debates in the WhatsApp group where people are livid that Ashley Cole is being mentioned, but
he was
for
my
me,
number one.
He is, without question, of all the positions, in my opinion, the best fullback the Premier League has ever seen. Yeah. Ever. Right?
And I think he's clear more like the second best. The gap between him and the second best agreed. Is clearer compared to everyone else.
Agreed. All right. And then Roy Keane is, for me, the most successful captain in Premier League history, probably. And I think Roy Keane is the embodiment of what the Premier League and football as a whole misses nowadays. I like combativeness. I like passion. I like people that won't shake your hand once the game's done and swap shirts and talk about whether you're going to go and have drinks. And I loved him as a player. I was a big fan. I loved it when he got sent off, when he, providing the game was won. I loved it all. So I'm a big fan of his. So those would be my two to get the ball rolling, but it's all close.
All right, Neil, who are your two?
I don't like it at all, by the way. I think in this country and around our fan club, and you're right to reference the Americanization of it, I think that supporters curate their own histories and their own values and their own heroes.
Yeah.
Supporters do that. They do that at the ground. They do it with song. They do it with banners. They do it themselves. They don't need the Premier League imposing it upon them. Alan Shearer doesn't belong to the Premier League. He belongs to Newcastle and ever so slightly to Blackburn. He doesn't belong to the Premier League. Thierry Henry does not belong to the Premier League. He was an incredible footballer, and I was pleased I got to watch him playing Premier League football, don't get me wrong. But he belongs to Arsenal. Does not belong to the Premier League. He is not a Premier League great. He's an Arsenal great. And it's Arsenal who should commemorate Thierry Henry, and every day you should be all commemorating Thierry Henry.
Just to be difficult and awkward, though, could the Premier League not say, well, it's our money that enabled Arsenal to get Thierry Henry?
They can. But what I would say, this is sort of an Americanization of what we do or don't do with our history. Our history is our history. It's not theirs. And, you know, this idea that it's going to end up with a bit of a public vote and there's going to be a bit of a ceremony. Listen, it's nice for the players, don't get me wrong. But Thierry Henry belongs to Arsenal and Alan Shearer belongs to Newcastle. And the other part about this is it's going to become, because of the way in which we treat our history, you've just had Marv there say, well, I can't have Steven Gerrard. What it then becomes is it'll become this thing where it'll be about one-upsmanship and it'll be about this and it'll be about that and it'll be about the other. So
only if you're petty, Neil, like Marvin.
But we're all petty.
Whoa. Well, let me be clear, right? Jordan. What I'll be clear is I guarantee...
You yourself to me, Marv. You're on my side.
Well, no, Neil, what I'm saying is I guarantee when it all comes out in the wash, United will over-index on who gets indoctrinated into the Hall of Fame, not just because of what they've done on the pitch, but because United just have a bigger fan base.
Exactly.
You've got more votes, right? Yep. It happens in the NFL, right? They do it every year for the Pro Bowl and the All-Star teams, and then some players, you're going, how did they get in there? And that's because of what they've done off the pitch, their social media following. So it's always going to be weighted and biased. Exactly. But Neil, I mean, I'm a man of, as George said, pettiness, but also petty integrity. So for me to pick Gerrard as one of my first two, I wouldn't be able to sleep at night. You know what it's like now. Come on.
I'm with you 100%, and that's my point. Yeah. You are backing my point up 100%. So with everything I've just said in mind, and I can defend both of these. Well, so one of them I'm certain on, they should do Kevin Phillips. If they want this to be real and about commemorating footballers who meant an awful lot to the Premier League, who scored an unbelievable amount of goals, who had a certain amount of iconic sort of stuff around them, it can't just be the lads who won the trophies. It's got to be other footballers.
He's not even shortlisted, though.
No, of course he's not, but that doesn't matter. It's got to be the other footballers. It's got to be the ones who came and meant something else. So I'd definitely have Kevin Phillips. And of the other, I would have one of Ruud Gullit, Gianfranco Zola and Jurgen Klinsmann. And the reason why is because when they come into English football, the impact they have as overseas players is absolutely massive. And they change the game.
I tell you, that is such a Neil answer. Let me pick four players.
But I'm just saying,
shortlisted.
What are those three? Pick one of those three because it should mean something.
I'm going to pick none because they're not shortlisted.
Well, that's fine. I mean, but you're worried about voting. I'm not talking about the vote. Forget the vote. The whole thing's a waste of our fucking time. They're just throwing us some sweets so we forget about the gross inequalities of English football.
I love it.
Talk about this for a few weeks so that you forget about the gross inequalities. Sunderland, have you heard of them recently? Oh, no. What do they do these days? Wow, that's an interesting story.
I'm just really wanting some light relief from a shitty week where they tried to take our game from us. But I take your point. I do agree with you, Neil. I do agree with you. Who are your two finally?
Be careful, G. Be careful.
Yeah. Rethink about this because it's going out.
Drogba on this list, G.
Drogba is on the list, but I'm not going to go for Drogba.
Okay,
I'd go for Drogba.
Because I kind of feel if there's going to... I mean, all of these will get on there eventually, right? But I do feel like it should go in kind of order as where you came in. I know some Hall of Fames do it like that. Like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame does it in years. So I was going to say, going back, I'd say Tony Adams and Peter Schmeichel. I think Peter Schmeichel, because it's probably going to take a little while for a keeper to get in there. And I need to push Peter Cech up as quickly as possible.
Always a motive.
I've been Tony Adams because he's the first great centre-back that I can remember. Can I be controversial as well and say, I'd say I'm 50-50 over whether Sol Campbell should be in this initial list. I think
if you asked me, the
invincible
one, come on, George, wasn't Lorraine invincible stadium? But no, what I was going to say is if there was one person I would drop from the list straight out of the gate, for me it would have been Les Ferdinand. And I like Les Ferdinand, but I just feel like around the rest of the list he would probably be the one I would drop out. And I'm really happy Letizia was on there. He would be my third one. I actually like Letizia as a player, and I feared him so much when we used to play Southampton. So, Neil, he would have been, if you're going to pick anyone out of the big ones, he would have been probably someone.
Well,
would have
the two you've just said there are probably the two I would definitely want to keep on the list.
What, Les Ferdinand?
Yeah, because he does a brilliant job for QPR. So the point about he does a great job for QPR. He goes to Newcastle, he doesn't win anything. He's got no honours all the way through his career. Tony Adams can look at his medals. Sol Campbell can look at his medals. Didier Drogba can look at his medals.
Oh, so what are you doing? You're doing it as a consolation prize for people not winning Premier League.
You did really well, lads. You've added loads to the league.
So George should be in that as well then.
I'm just not sure if any of these guys, if you asked them, would you rather have a Hall of Fame as a consolation for the Premier League? Yeah. I think they'd all go, I'd rather have the Premier League, right? I'm not sure it gets anywhere near as consolation, right? Maybe it's a consolation for like Son in years gone by for winning the Carabao Cup.
Yeah.
But for the league, you're getting thin there. But I hear what you're saying.
Guys, thank you very much. Oh, man. G, Neil, Marvin, thanks for coming on the pod this week. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. All the podcast outlets, we're across Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We'll find Ollie and dig him out from somewhere, and we'll bring him back on the pod for the next one. Until next week, peace.